initiated into spaniel aggression syndrome and cocker rage as concepts. Are these things that you knew about with these cute crossbred dogs?
I know about tabby tantrums in my house, that's for sure. But you've got a beautiful dog.
I have she's got, very but well she's behaved. A pure breed, so she hasn't been crossed with anybody. But she's a rescue dog, and I always think there's a great karma involved in rescuing a dog. They're so grateful. Hopefully, it means that they're a very happy addition to the family. I'm very against all of the modern mixing of breeds, Mark. I think it's very cruel, and it's come to fruition in appallingly bad behaviour. Go figure.
Yes. Well, we at home, my son has a Maltese Bichon Frise something cross, and I definitely recognise the separation anxiety that Rowena was talking about there. Anyway,
apart from your son.
All of us. That's it for me. Thank you so much for your company. Aisha Hazarika is on from 1 o'clock tomorrow. And the producer of The Times at One was Chris Eastwood, and Ryan Boyden was on the pedals and indeed pressing the buttons. On The Times next week, it's Times at One next week, it's Joe Coben. But from me, for now, goodbye.
Across the UK, on DAB, online and on your smart speaker, this is Times Radio, the voice of the times.
Thank you very much, Mark. 2 o'clock now, and a very good sunny afternoon to you. It's Jane Garvey and Fee Glover on Times Radio.
And between now and 4 o'clock, Pete Hegseth demands ungrateful Europeans thank Donald Trump for the war with Iran as gas prices soar. We're going to get the very latest from a reporter in the Middle East and examine how the conflict could continue to hurt the UK finances. Teaching unions are warning about big tech's little victims. We'll talk to a head teacher whose experiment proved what children are really shown on social media and the consequences. We'll hear from a biographer of Mary Anning about why the world-famous fossil hunter got really sick of fossils. And our big guest after 3:30 is the poet, writer and comedian Pam Ayres.
Here's the news at 2 o'clock. Laura Cook.
Thank you. Good afternoon. Leading European nations say they're ready to join appropriate efforts to ensure safe passage through the Strait of Hormuz. Sir Keir Starmer has issued a joint statement condemning Iran's attacks on shipping and oil and gas facilities in the Gulf. Meanwhile, the US Defence Secretary has vowed to finish the job in the war against Iran. Pete Hegseth's words follow a huge surge in gas prices worldwide, triggered by a series of attacks on crucial energy infrastructure sites in Iran and Qatar. He's also hit out at countries including the UK and France.
The world, the Middle East, our ungrateful allies in Europe should be saying one thing to President Trump. Thank you. Thank you for the courage to stop this terror state from holding the world hostage with missiles while building or attempting to build a nuclear bomb. Thank you for doing the work of the free world.
The COVID inquiry has found the NHS came close to collapse during the pandemic and only just coped. Its chair, Baroness Hallett, says the enormous strain placed on healthcare systems was unprecedented. That include delays to diagnosis and treatment across the UK, as well as flaws within initial efforts to prevent the spread of infection. James Telfer, who speaks for bereaved families, says labelled the report utterly damning.
It shouldn't take the deaths of our loved ones from COVID to put health back on the political agenda. That's why what happens now is so important. This report must not be left to gather dust, and its recommendations should be the floor, not the ceiling, of the government's ambitions.
The Bank of England has held interest rates at 3.75%. It's also raised its inflation forecast for the summer from 2% to as much as 3.5% because of the recent spike in energy prices. Reform UK has proposed cutting the number of MSPs and quangos as it launches its campaign for the Scottish elections in May. To reduce the number of MSPs, it pledges to cut the number of constituencies from 73 to 57. The 27-page document also suggests shutting down the quangos and returning powers to democratically elected ministers supported by the civil service. Kemi Badenoch has backed her shadow justice secretary, who criticised a public Muslim prayer event in Trafalgar Square. Nick Timothy called it an act of domination and division. The Conservative leader says one of the problems was that women and men were segregated.
This is not about stopping anyone from any religion from practising their faith. We want to see religious festivities in Trafalgar Square, but they have to be inclusive and also respectful of British culture.
Labour's called Nick Timothy's comments a disgrace. The Home Office is defending putting up the cost of a standard UK passport, saying it'll reduce reliance on taxpayer funding. The price of online applications is rising to more than £100 for the first time from next month. For under-16s, it'll increase to £66.50. And a gnome ban will be lifted at the world-famous Chelsea Flower Show for the second time in history. The Royal Horticultural Society says it wants celebrities to decorate gnomes to feature in this year's show. They'll then auction them off for charity. And don't forget, you can set the Times Radio News Briefing as your news service on Alexa.
Across the UK, on DAB Digital Radio, on the Times Radio app, online, and on your smart speaker.
Jane Garvey and Fee Glover on Times Radio with Wickes Kitchens and Bathrooms.
It's 4 minutes past two. It's clear blue skies here in London. We hope that's the case where you are this afternoon. It seems so incongruous with the doom on the horizon, doesn't it? The worst energy crisis the world has ever seen. That is the stark forecast from some quarters. And we'll talk about that with the economist Greg Karlstrom in just a couple of moments' time. And some very interesting breaking news out of Qatar as well, which we will talk about imminently. Otherwise in the programme, here comes a question. Was Mary Anning sick of fossils? When the Queen of Fossil Hunting wrote a letter to a friend, we don't know who it was, she says that she's got totally fed up with it all. We'll discuss that. Could justice finally be about to be served to the man accused of the murder of Patrice Lumumba? The Congolese Prime Minister was murdered in 1961. An ex-Belgian diplomat has finally been charged. Jamal Kerins brings us the magazine with the glint in its eye. That's the Saturday Times magazine. She'll be here at about a quarter to three, and also with news of what's in her first Saturday afternoon permanent show.
Oh yeah, it starts this week.
It does. So we'll talk to her about that too. And after three, what exactly do we mean when we say harmful content? It comes up in so many discussions right now, doesn't it? Whether we're talking about the Online Safety Act, the controls on social media companies, the manosphere, the direction of AI. But what exactly is in our phones and the phones of our children? What is that content? Well, we have voiced up some of the messages that our children are on the receiving end of. And it's really horrendous stuff. Prepare yourself. We'll give you another warning. But it's important that we all hear it. That happens after three. After 3:30, we were going to be bringing you...
Break it to them gently.
Absolute British national treasure. We advised you to have a very, very strong cup of tea. A little stool to put your feet up on and a great big slice of fruitcake.
Well, but the good news is you can still have all those
exactly.
things. Because what we've done is...
We just swapped one national treasure for another.
Yeah, and we were hoping to bring you Monty Don, but for reasons, I think, logistical, he's not able to be with us today. But we're sending our very best to him. Hope to talk to him soon, because he has written a genuinely beautiful book called British Gardens, and I know lots of people would want to hear about it. But don't worry, because... Pam Ayres, MBE, is with us instead.
Brilliant.
And she does read a poem during the course of the conversation, and it's the one about online shopping, which a lot of people will be able to relate to. She's just a delight. She's 79 now, Pam Ayres, has been bringing pleasure to many, many thousands of people for much of her life. And she's just a good person to hear from on a beautiful spring-like day. She's a big, big wildlife enthusiast as well. Her latest book is a really wonderfully illustrated children's book about a dormouse. Oh, it's got a really high cuddly factor.
That's what we need.
Well,
isn't it?
It is what we
it
need.
It is what yeah. we need.
So that's at about 25 to 4 this afternoon.
What is on the most read stories this afternoon?
Well, can I just say that the breaking news that you alluded to earlier, I'm trying to make sense of it, and it's various reports now from the Middle East. We're told that Shell, which is the world's largest liquefied natural gas trader, and this is what Al Jazeera and Reuters are reporting, has declared force majeure on cargoes it buys from Qatar Energy and sells to its clients worldwide. This being reported by Reuters right now. Now, force majeure means that a company can be released from contractual obligations, contracts basically, without any kind of penalty. In other words, it's bad news, isn't it?
It is.
Yeah.
So the storm clouds really are gathering. We can't underestimate what this is going to mean to all of us, and it's where we're going to start after we've done the most read stories, which will have changed, but about 3 minutes ago they were.
Yeah, well, let's we are going to talk in a moment to the economist Greg Karlstrom, who'll make sense of everything that's been happening in the Middle East. At number three in the most read stories on the website, stay-at-home advice during COVID costs lives, inquiry concludes. The chair of the inquiry, Baroness Hallett, says that people missed out on life-saving care due to guidance drawn up under Prime Minister Boris Johnson, which didn't have input from health leaders. The second most read story, comedian's £4 million estate goes to shelter nearly a decade after his death. A judge has ruled on the imprecise wording in the homemade will of the great, and it has to be said, very generous comedian Sean Hughes, who was a pioneering star of the stand-up circuit. Well, thank goodness that has all finally been sorted. And the most read piece on the Times website, Iran war live, ungrateful European allies should thank Trump, Hegseth says. This is the war secretary, Hegseth, adding that the US is hitting Iran with, quotes, overwhelming force as UK gas prices leapt 25% following strikes on energy facilities. Now, all of these articles are on thetimes.com. You can get a digital subscription by going to thetimes.com/subscribe. Let's go then to what is the biggest story globally right now. The UK and allies, including France, Italy, Japan and Germany, say they are ready to help provide safe passage to ships going through the vital Strait of Hormuz. Normally, a fifth of the world's oil passes through the waterway, but it is, of course, blockaded currently by Iran. These allies, though, have been criticised by Pete Hegseth, so-called US Secretary of War. Here he is speaking a little earlier.
The Middle East, our ungrateful allies in Europe, even segments of our own press, should be saying one thing to President Trump. Thank you. Thank you for the courage to stop this terror state from holding the world hostage with missiles while building or attempting to build a nuclear bomb. Thank you for doing the work of the free world.
That was Pete Hegseth. I need to be absolutely clear about what I said earlier. That report from Reuters was from a week ago, in fact, so absolutely my fault there, my bad. But we are told, and Felix can tell me again in my headphones, that we may have to declare force majeure on long-term contracts of liquid natural gas is what the Qataris are saying today. So it's still not good news. But it's not quite as definitive as I might have indicated.
It is still not good news. Well, but it could be the opposite, couldn't it? It could actually be across so many other companies if it's coming from a nation rather than specific companies. So just as soon as we get a little bit more clarity on that, we will let you know.
Well, let's bring in, actually, Greg Karlstrom, who's Middle East correspondent for The Economist. Greg, where are you at the moment? I think you're in Dubai, aren't you?
I'm in Riyadh at the moment in Saudi Arabia.
Okay. So just to that bit of confusion there about force majeure and what it might mean for the rest of us, any idea? Can you enlighten us at all?
So we don't have any official statement yet from Qatar Energy, which is the state-owned gas company in Qatar that operates this LNG plant along with Shell. They've already suspended operations about 2 weeks ago now after the first Iranian drone attack on that liquefaction plant, which basically takes gas, chills it down to extremely low temperatures, liquefies it, and then loads it onto tankers. About 20% of the world's liquefied natural gas comes from there. So they've halted operations. They've declared force majeure on some contracts already, the sort of near-term ones that they have. These reports that are coming out are referencing longer-term contracts, things that were signed, you know, for years in the future, for delivery years in the future. Obviously, if they do end up invoking force majeure, which is sort of the act of God clause in a contract, it means there would be a sustained hit to global natural gas supplies for years to come. We don't know if that's happened yet, but there was an Iranian ballistic missile strike on that liquefaction plant overnight. I'm told it caused extensive damage. They're still assessing the extent of it. And so it's not impossible that there will be a prolonged interruption of supply.
Okay. As we speak now, then we are in a pretty perilous state. I think it's fair to say economically, and of course that sounds parochial because you have to bear in mind the genuine suffering of so many people on the ground in Lebanon and in Iran and elsewhere who are suffering horrifically. Pete Hegseth, the U.S. Secretary of War, his language is getting to our ears more and more unappealing. Is it the sight and sound of a panicked administration, do you think?
I think there's some panic. I think Hegseth always speaks for an audience of one. I mean, he goes up to the podium at these press conferences with the hope that the White House will clip up some excerpts and show them to the boss, and the boss will be happy with him. But I think not just his panicked language, but some of the things we're seeing the administration do today. About an hour ago, Scott Bessent, the Treasury Secretary, said in a television interview that the U.S. would be waiving some sanctions on Iranian oil, allowing people to buy Iranian oil that had previously been under American sanctions. Now, that obviously sounds like a bizarre thing to do whilst the U.S. is also fighting a war with Iran. So the fact that they're taking these sorts of measures, I think, tells you just how severe this energy crisis is getting and how few ideas the Americans have to deal with it.
I mean, that is quite extraordinary. Has that been challenged in public? Are people questioning that?
I mean, I'm sure they will. It's just happened in the past hour or so, the announcement. Now, he's talking about, he says, Iranian oil that is already on the water. It's been loaded onto tankers and it hasn't yet been delivered for want of buyers because it's difficult to buy Iranian oil on account of these sanctions. And even if you do buy it, there are questions about whether Iran can actually access the proceeds of that oil sale. So we're not talking necessarily about a multi-billion dollar windfall immediately for the regime, but still allowing the Iranians to export and sell oil at a time when America's allies in the Gulf, many of them, can't get their oil and gas out to markets. It's not going to go over well, not just with Americans, I think, but with American partners in the Middle East.
Right. The Pentagon is asking for more money, $200 billion to continue to be able to pay for the war. Hegseth, I'm just quoting him here, he said, it takes money to kill bad guys. What about the reaction to that? How long can that amount of money, that expense, be sustained, do you think?
I don't know if Congress is going to appropriate that amount of money. It sounds like an enormous opening request from the administration that will then be whittled down in negotiations with lawmakers. I mean, it has been a very, very expensive war so far. We have a piece in The Economist this week looking at the munitions that America used in the early days of the fighting. And just in the first few days, the precision sort of standoff long-range missiles and the interceptors that America used probably cost something between $20 and $26 billion to replace. That's just a few days' worth of munitions. And the longer this goes on, the more that cost is going to mount. I think for Congress and for other people in America, the concern won't just be about the dollar figure. It will be, if they're asking for $200 billion, how long do they expect this war to continue? Remember, Trump in the beginning was talking about maybe a few days, maybe 2 to 3 weeks. We're finishing our third week now, and there is no end in sight.
And really briefly, if you can, who or what continues to run Iran? Who's giving the instructions? So many of the leaders have been, it has to be said, very successfully picked off. So who's in charge?
It's a very good question. We don't know for sure. I think it is not the supreme leader, Mujtaba Khamenei, who no one has seen since he was appointed to the job. There are reports that he was injured. I think that's probably true. Mohammad Qalibaf, the Speaker of Parliament, is one of the last surviving, very senior, very powerful figures. I'm sure he's playing a central role. But then to some extent, I think power has also been decentralized, and some of what we're seeing Iran do with these attacks on neighboring countries, it's not even being directed from the top necessarily. It's individual commanders sort of taking their own initiative and lashing out willy-nilly at countries around the Gulf.
Greg Karlstrom in Riyadh for The Economist. Thank you very much indeed. Appreciate your expertise this afternoon. So natural gas prices have risen 25% in Britain today. The price of a barrel of crude oil topped out at about $118. Stephen Millard is Deputy Director of the National Institute of Economic and Social Research. What about the possible impact, Stephen, of Qatar declaring force majeure on these long-term gas contracts? To those of us who have to pay our heating bills, what could that mean?
Well, what it'll mean is higher heating bills is the very quick answer. We were hoping that gas prices would, or wholesale gas prices would come down into the future, thinking of the war ending quickly. If Qatar were to declare a force majeure, then we can expect very, very high wholesale gas prices for a long time. And if that is the case, then it will be fairly inevitable that gas and electricity prices for households will rise, and it will be very difficult for the government to commit to taking action to reduce those, given that that rise is likely to be a very, very persistent one.
And, I mean, that money, as has been the case with previous bailouts, at some point it has to be paid back.
Well, exactly, and that's the point. If the rise in wholesale gas was just going to be a couple of months or something, then, you know, there might be scope for the government to intervene in the next price cap that's going to be announced that will kick in July. But if, on the other hand, wholesale prices are going to be higher for much, much longer, then it would get incredibly expensive for the government to intervene.
And petrol prices are, well, a lot of people would say when I last went to fill up, it was considerably more than it had been the month before. They're just going to keep on going up as well, presumably.
Yeah, exactly. We can, I mean, the thing is, petrol prices respond very, very quickly to changes in oil prices. So as the oil price has risen from $60 a barrel to $100 a barrel, you've seen petrol rise from about £1.20, £1.25 to already about £1.40 a litre. That comes through pretty quickly. I mean, the good news on that is that if the war were to end quickly and oil supplies were to resume, then we might see petrol prices come back down again pretty quickly. But as it is, we're getting higher petrol prices, we're getting higher gas and electricity prices. This is going to affect inflation immediately. The bank has already said that inflation is likely to be 3.5% later this year rather than 2%, could even go higher than that. And of course, this is a problem for firms who are already struggling with higher taxes, etc. If energy prices for them are going to be higher as well, then that's going to pass through into the prices of pretty much everything.
So if you were Rachel Reeves this afternoon, and frankly, who'd want to be, what would you do?
Well, that's a very, very good question. I mean, I would be hoping that there was some way of de-escalating the conflict. And you mentioned earlier the human suffering as well that's happening out there. We'd love to see the conflict de-escalated, hopefully get the Straits of Hormuz open so that oil starts passing through freely, hope that Qatar does not declare a force majeure on its gas. But if all of those things didn't happen, then I think the Chancellor has a real problem in that she cannot afford, I think, to promise unlimited support for energy bills for households. And yet at the same time, you know, she has already said that she will provide some support. So I think the answer, you hit it in one, is who would want to be in Rachel's position just now?
Thank you. Stephen Millard, Deputy Director of the National Institute of Economic and Social Research.
Now, Cherie is one of our regular listeners. It's always good to know that you're out there, Cherie. And I think that she speaks for an awful lot of people this afternoon, Jane, when saying, I'm so hoping this will be Trump's undoing. This is very unpopular. The higher gas goes, the madder people get. It does seem to be that we've had a man without a plan in charge of something that never had a plan.
The world.
It still doesn't have a plan.
Don't panic, everybody.
And everybody is caught in the crosshairs. Coming up, why was the world's most famous fossil hunter fed up with them? You're listening to Jane and Fee on Times Radio with Wickes, the experts in kitchens and bathrooms.
Jane Mulkerins on Times Radio.
Join me, Jane Mulkerins, every Saturday afternoon, right here on Times Radio. I'll be bringing you everything from politics to popular culture. We'll have big thinkers on my news panel, a healthy smattering of celebrity, and if you've got a personal dilemma that you just can't solve, bring it here. I've even got an agony aunt slash uncle on hand with sage advice.
Jane Mulkerins starts this Saturday from 1 on Times Radio.
This spring, start your own story in Scotland. Step into a land where the views are wild, the welcomes are warm, and the magic is real. From lofty mountains to vibrant cities, explore Scotland's breathtaking landscapes and uncover our ancient history. And with an exciting range of cultural events and festivals to enjoy, spring is the perfect time to plan your escape. Write your own Scottish story this spring. Start your adventure at visitscotland.com/spring.
Feel that? That little buzz of excitement? That's the weekly flutter. With chances to win up to £10,000, enter British Heart Foundation's lottery for a thrill with goodwill behind it. Because when you play, it helps fund life-saving research. So go on, keep playing, keep winning, keep us beating. Search BHF Lottery. Gamble responsibly. Over 18s only. T's and C's apply. Please see our website for more details. British Heart Foundation is a registered charity.
Listen to Times Radio at 6:30 every weekday morning for your indispensable briefing on the latest politics, business and sports news of the day.
Jane Garvey and Fee Glover on Times Radio with Wix. Let Wix install your new kitchen. Choose from a wide range of kitchens and add the option of installation to your order. For complete peace of mind, all installations include a 2-year workmanship guarantee. Get started by booking a free design appointment at wix.co.uk.
Now, there is an exciting competition on Times Radio. Can you hear the lightness in our voices as we we turn aside from war and disaster and we head to holidays. Oh, this is in association with Times Holidays, the new service from the Times, where our travel experts help you build and book your perfect holiday. Now, you could win a fantastic week for two on the beautiful island of Madeira. Have you ever been to Madeira?
I haven't.
Would you like to?
Yes.
Enter the competition. The package includes flights and transfers. It's worth over £5,000. For your chance to win this great prize, courtesy of Times Holidays, simply go online and search for Times Radio Competitions, and the entry form is there on the website. Now, the competition closes at midnight tonight, so do hurry. All the terms and conditions are there online too, and Jane and I say good luck. The world's most famous fossil hunter was sick of fossils. Mary Anning, who made a series of groundbreaking discoveries of the Dorset Coast in the 19th century, once wrote, "Fossils make me sick," in a newly discovered letter. Now, the Lyme Regis Museum, built on the site of Anning's old house, has launched a crowdfunding campaign to buy the letter fragment. We can talk now to Tom Sharp, geologist and biographer of Mary Anning. Tom, a very good afternoon from us. Just in case our listeners aren't fully aware, what's the significance of this? Mary Anning really deserves her place in our history, doesn't she?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, she's one of the most important figures in paleontology in the early 19th century. And her fame is celebrated worldwide today. And she's commemorated on, well, there's a wonderful statue, which was unveiled a couple of years ago down in Lyme Regis. She's been on stamps. There have been coins commemorating her and stamps from other countries as well. So she's really well known in the paleontological and geological community. And she was famous in her time for her discoveries.
Tell us about this fragment then. Do we know much more about the letter that it has been torn from?
No, this is the most frustrating thing, actually. There are only about 4 dozen letters of Mary Anning surviving, which seems a lot, but actually when you put it in the context of some of her male contemporaries, other geologists that she knew, they left archives of thousands of items. So anything from Mary Anning is of importance. And most of the surviving correspondence deals with her business. She was a dealer in fossils. She was selling these on to collectors and to scientists at the time. But this is really unusual because this is a personal letter or a fragment of a personal letter. And it's just so frustrating that it is just a fragment. We'd love to know who it's to. I think it's to a woman friend, and it's certainly a friend. It's not a sort of business associate. It's a friend, and that friend has just been to see her in Lyme Regis. And there's also been a lady, I think, or ladies visiting her. And Annie's got a wee bit frustrated by this. I don't know quite what the situation was, but she's got a bit frustrated and she's getting a bit fed up.
Yeah.
I mean, we all get fed up from time to time. Oh, with what we're doing.
Absolutely. And it's just such a fantastic little insight into a world that so many of us would recognise. The fragment says, and I'm going to quote here, "Worn out after you saw me, that I almost wish that I might never see a lady again. And the name of Fossils makes me sick with its concomitance." It's signed, "Gratefully yours, Mary Anning." So you're absolutely right there, Tom. I mean, she's just doing that quite usual thing when you've had maybe a house guest outstay their welcome. And he's like, "I just don't ever want to see them again." But do we know also why the fragment was torn from the letter? Where was it found? Does that point us in the right direction?
Well, it comes from a 19th century autograph collection. Collecting autographs, you know, popular today, and it goes back well into the 19th century. And what it does show is that certainly after Anning's death, which was in 1847, and even during her life, people were interested in her, and her fame was such that people wanted to add her signature to their autograph collections. So that, I think, is the source of it. Now, sometimes these autograph collections just have a little cutout signature from a letter. Sometimes it's the whole letter. In this case, we've got a wee bit more, but that's really tantalising.
Isn't it?
It could be a great thing for Lyme Regis Museum because it's a great way of engaging people because you've now got something personal, something tangible you can link to with Mary Anning. You can build a story. You can imagine what's going through her head. What's the situation that's arisen the way she's written this? So it brings her to life as a person rather than just, you know, a name of a paleontologist in a book.
She didn't have the easiest of lives, Tom, did she, as you've already alluded to? I mean, she was a woman who did something extraordinary in a time when her field was dominated by men. But also she was one of 10 children, only two of whom survived. I mean, even for those times, that's harsh, isn't it?
It is. I mean, you know, there was 9 children we now know. We used to think it was 10, there was 9. But, you know, two out of 9 surviving to adulthood is really quite extraordinary. And, I mean, it flags up the sort of improvements that have been in public health in the last 150 years or so. And vaccination was just coming in at that time for smallpox, for example. So things were starting to change. But, yeah, to lose, you know, her mother must have been a really remarkable, resilient woman to stand up to losing 7 of her 9 children and her husband as well.
Yeah, gosh, how painful. That's an awful lot of grief in one life, isn't it?
Yeah.
We mentioned the crowdfunding campaign and how wonderful it would be if the Lyme Regis Museum was able to buy this. Do you know much about the campaign and how much money they might need?
Well, the estimate, I think, for the auction is 6,000 to 8,000. And, of course, there are always fees on top of that. So I think we're aiming to get, I think, about £10,000. But every contribution is very welcome because you'd never know with an auction how much it's going to go for. Full Anning letters would sell for 30, 50,000 or so. And there was a remarkable one which came out, again, of an autograph collection 6 years ago, which went for over £100,000. And so that's the kind of attraction that Anning has for collectors. But, you know, donations are always welcome and via the Lyme Regis Museum website and the Friends of Lyme Regis Museum who are coordinating this fundraising. If you'd like to make a donation, we'd love to have that.
Well, we've got some very erudite and generous listeners to Times Radio, so let's hope something good might come of our interview, Tom. Thank you very much indeed for telling us about that. That's Tom Sharp, who's written a book. He is the biographer of Mary Anning. Her life was incredible, wasn't it? Her contribution to our understanding now of extinction, apart from anything else, is absolutely second to none.
It's funny, Lyme Regis is, I don't know, punches above its weight, doesn't it, really? Because there's... Which books were set? There was The French Lieutenant's Woman. That's in Lyme Regis, isn't it?
Yeah, there was a great Mark Hicks restaurant there.
Yeah, Persuasion, Jane Austen, bit of Lyme Regis action.
And The Dinosaurs.
And The Dinosaurs. I mean, it's all been going on there. It's amazing how some places nothing ever happens, but Lyme Regis, no, a lot going on. Right, coming up, a 93-year-old Belgian former diplomat has been charged over the murder of the first ever leader of the Congo. Could this be justice for one of the great crimes of the 20th century? You're with Times Radio just after 2:30. Here are the headlines. Laura Cook.
Across the UK, on DAB, online and on your smart speaker, this is Times Radio.
Thank you. Good afternoon. There are concerns force majeure could be declared on long-term contracts on liquid natural gas. Iran's attacks on Qatar have damaged facilities that produce 17% of Qatar Energy's liquefied natural gas export capacity. The CEO there has said it will take 3 to 5 years to repair them. If a force majeure is declared, a company can be released from contracts without any penalty. Greg Karlstrom, Middle East correspondent for The Economist, explains we're not there yet, but could be.
They've declared force majeure on some contracts already, the sort of near-term ones that they have. These reports that are coming out are referencing longer-term contracts, things that were signed for years in the future, for delivery years in the future. Obviously, if they do end up invoking force majeure, which is sort of the act of God clause in a contract, it means there would be a sustained hit to global natural gas supplies for years to come.
The COVID inquiry's third module has concluded the NHS only just coped during the pandemic, coming close to collapse. A report looking at the impact on UK healthcare systems found flaws, including a constrained amount of PPE and a struggle to cope with demand for 111 services. The Bank of England has held interest rates at 3.75%. It was widely expected as the conflict in the Middle East continues to drive concerns around a spike in inflation. And more than 900 students at the University of Kent have now been vaccinated following an outbreak of meningitis in the county. The number of cases connected to the virus has risen to 27. And don't forget, you can set the Times Radio news briefing as your news service on Alexa.
This is Times Radio.
The UK government is backing businesses with no-fee recruitment support from Job Centre Plus.
I'm Sophie Smith, Chief People Officer at Compass Group UK and Ireland, the UK's largest food and support services company. We need talent at scale across the country fast. We're working with Job Centre Plus to help find great people. Their local employer advisors help us advertise vacancies, connect us with motivated candidates, and last year alone, our partnership drove thousands of applications. We've also created something we're really proud of, the Accelerate with Edgbaston Hospitality Hub in partnership with Job Centre Plus. It's helping us bring local people into real careers. We provide on-the-job training as well as access to a range of apprenticeships from entry to degree level.
I'm Amir. My life changed the day I went to Job Centre Plus. I found my spark.
If you're a business looking to recruit, Job Centre Plus could help you find talent that delivers. Visit business.gov.uk/recruit to find out how. Eligibility criteria apply.
Young people today, can they really handle responsibility? Or are we just kidding ourselves?
Welcome to McDonald's.
And a mayo chicken.
Some think young people can't manage. We disagree. That's why one in three McDonald's managers are under 25.
Hey, Kira.
Hey, Val. How are you?
You all right? Yeah, I'm good. It's busy out there, though.
Like Kira from South London. She's 23 and manages a team of 20.
Let's go.
Leadership. Making it happen at McDonald's.
Daryl Morris wraps up the weekend's news and takes a look at the week ahead, Saturday and Sunday from 10 p.m.
Jane Garvey and Fee Glover on Times Radio with Wix. Let Wix install your new kitchen. Choose from a wide range of kitchens and add the option of installation to your order. For complete peace of mind, all installations include a 2-year workmanship guarantee. Get started by booking a free design appointment at wix.co.uk.
So John Pienaar will join us here on Times Radio from 4 o'clock with his Drive Time show until 7. He'll have the latest on the war in the Middle East, including talking to our business correspondent colleague Dominic O'Connell. That's about concerns, as we were reporting earlier, that Qatar is likely, we're told, to declare force majeure on long-term gas supply contracts. This is something Dominic has described as bad news. So John will find out more about why and what impact it will have on the rest of us. And this is interesting. Also, John's going to be hearing from Times Radio's political editor, Anna Mihailova. And Anna has been talking to Kemi Badenoch. And the Tory party leader has been telling Anna what she'd do if she came across an incident of shoplifting.
If you're in that shop and you see someone doing that, would you intervene?
I think it depends on how big they are.
Good answer. And similarly...
But yes, broadly would be my instinct. I think people should look after their personal safety. I think those people who are stronger should do more. I know that there is now a tendency for people not to put themselves in harm's way. But I also think that sometimes we need to send a message that this is not acceptable.
There we are. That's Kemi Badenoch. What would you do? Would you tackle a shoplifter? Well, you can hear the rest of that interview on Times Radio Drive with John Pienaar from 4 o'clock.
It's a good question. Would you?
Well, I was in a supermarket on Sunday and there was a shoplifter. And not only did I not tackle him.
I wondered where the story was going.
Yes, it was me. No, it wasn't me. There was an incident of shoplifting. And certainly the staff in the store talked about it, but just let the bloke go. There was absolutely no question of anyone, and nor should they, by the way. I didn't really feel that somebody who's working on the shop floor of a major supermarket should put themselves on the line because some geezer had marched in and nicked a bit of stuff. So they just decided to let him go, and off he went. But there is something annoying about it, because, I mean, as a punter who was queuing up to pay, I was angry that this idiot thought he could get away without paying.
Yeah,
it's insulting.
It makes me livid. Well, yeah, we've talked about this on the podcast, haven't we? And I think there is a distinction to be made. There may well be some cases of unbelievable hardship. I'm not sure that I would tut or intervene at all if maybe I saw somebody slip in a little bit of formula.
If you're stealing nappies, I think that's slightly different.
I definitely would have a different moral judgment about it. But I've seen people well-dressed in M&S helping themselves to security-tagged steak and walking out the door with a smug smile on their face because they also know that the security guard can't do anything once they actually get to the pavement outside.
Right.
And that makes me absolutely fuming.
Yeah, I think if you're nicking ham hock and a bottle of claret, you don't deserve any sympathy.
No.
You should be nabbed.
So that is centrist middle-aged people.
Absolutely. The centrist nans have spoken.
We would love to hear your thoughts about that. It's a very interesting question from Anna Mihailova. And you can hear, as Jane said, all of that interview in John Pienaar's programme starts at 4 o'clock. Now, here is a story for you. A Belgian ex-diplomat is going to stand trial in connection with one of the great colonial crimes of the 20th century. Etienne Davignon is accused of complicity in the murder of the first Congolese Prime Minister, Patrice Lumumba, in 1961. Davignon is a former European commissioner. He's now set to face a court on charges of war crimes. Stuart Reid is the author of The Lumumba Plot, The Secret History of the CIA and a Cold War Assassination. Stuart, a very good afternoon from us. Just remind us exactly what happened to Patrice Lumumba.
Lumumba was the Congo's first prime minister. He was democratically elected, and within days of his country becoming independent in June 1960, the entire country fell apart. Long story short, the West, including Belgium and the United States, worried that Lumumba was going to take the country communist and deliver it to the Soviet camp. And so many different actors tried to overthrow and kill Lumumba. And he was indeed eventually overthrown by Mobutu, who ended up becoming the country's longtime dictator. And he was indeed killed in January 1961.
How old was he when he was murdered?
He was just 35 years old. And part of the tragedy was that the country was sort of stunted originally at its birth and never got a chance to develop and have its full post-colonial independence. It had this grave crime that forever put Congo on a path towards, you know, ruin and poverty from which it really hasn't emerged to this day.
What have you discovered about that secret history of the CIA and its involvement in the death of Patrice Lumumba?
So the CIA is, I would argue, the main bad actor here because it played a very specific and deadly role in the crisis. President Eisenhower ordered Lumumba's assassination. The CIA sent a chemist to Congo who carried poisons that were intended to be delivered into Lumumba's food or toothpaste. That poisoning plot sort of fizzled out. But when Lumumba was eventually killed, the CIA played a role by giving a green light to his transfer from one part of the country to another where it was certain he'd be killed. Okay. The CIA also was giving cash to the man that replaced him, Mobutu, and installed him as dictator, essentially.
So tell us then about this man who has been charged. And have there been charges before, or has anybody ever come as close to prosecution as this D'Avignon man has?
So there's been zero accountability for what Belgium and the United States and also the UN did to Congo in 1960 and 1961. The Lumumba family has argued correctly that, you know, they are still seeking justice 60 plus years later. What I worry, though, with this this trial that's now going to take place is that what we're going to get is the illusion of justice rather than actual justice. So the man who was accused, Etienne D'Avignon, was a 27-year-old intern in the Belgian Foreign Ministry at the time. There's not much evidence that he was deeply involved in the events that led to Lumumba's death. He played a very small role in pushing for Lumumba to be overthrown by Congo's president at the time. And he seemed to know that Lumumba was going to be transferred just before his death, although he didn't know where. But what I worry is that because he's the sole surviving member of the class of people who could plausibly be prosecuted, what's happening here is a sort of convenient way for Belgium to virtue signal that it's doing the work of accountability, when in fact it's not really anything close to that.
Right. So it's a kind of atonement for the sins of the past. How old is Mr. D'Avignon now?
He's 93 years old. And, you know, it's a separate question what to do with people who are that old. And you know, there's precedent with aging Nazis who have indeed been prosecuted. But what I think is sort of the problematic aspect of this case is the role that he actually played, which was minimal and highly indirect. What real accountability would look like is something different. I mean, there'd be a true formal apology on the part of the Belgian government. The Belgian government has issued varying apologies over the years, but they tend to blame individual officials rather than the Belgian state as an institution. The Belgian king used the passive voice when he apologized for the acts done under colonialism. The United States, for its part, could open up the archival record and fully declassify everything related to Congo. That would be much more meaningful and important at this stage than prosecuting D'Avignon.
Do you know, does anybody know, what the family of Patrice Lumumba would like?
They have been involved in bringing this case, which is you know, how Belgian law works, that you know, families of victim members can bring a complaint. You know, their last victory, so to speak, was in 2022 when the Belgian government finally handed over the last remaining remnant of Lumumba's body, which was a tooth that a Belgian police commissioner had kept as a sort of gruesome souvenir from when he was tasked with burying Lumumba's body and then dissolving it in a vat of sulfuric acid. So I sympathize with the family entirely, and they have been poorly treated by the Belgian government, but I don't think this is the right solution.
Right. I mean, that is such a ghoulish detail, isn't it, about the end of his life. And gosh, was that known to his family at the time, that that's what had happened to his remains?
It emerged in bits and pieces over the decades. The fact that the tooth was still in Belgium came out only in the early 2000s, and only in 2016 was there a real move to obtain the tooth from the daughter of the now dead man who had plucked it from Lumumba's mouth. Really, the story of Lumumba's assassination has been emerging over years and years and years, but to this day, 65 years later, there's still documents that are classified and still details we don't know.
How have you managed to find out so much about the CIA's involvement? Because I would have thought that protocol and the kind of, you know, the dark arts of diplomacy and secrecy would make that very difficult indeed, Stuart.
Well, in my book, The Lumumba Plot, I used a variety of sources. I mean, the CIA itself, to its credit, declassified a large trove of cables in 2013, I believe. And that allowed me to, for the first time, tell the sort of day-by-day story of the CIA's involvement. I also interviewed, aging Congolese people who, whose parents were involved in the crisis at the time. I read, many memoirs and obscure academic books and reports. But the key source really has been the CIA's own declassification efforts. And yet still, there are so many more documents we don't have. So many of the documents I did have redactions throughout them, which, you know, at this point, 65 years on, there's truly nothing from 1960 and 1961 that deserves to be secret. Mm-hmm.
Thank you very much indeed for telling us that story. Stuart Reed is the author of The Lumumba Plot, The Secret History of the CIA and a Cold War Assassination.
And for balance, let's have a little bit of, a different side of the what are the Trump administration debate. What are the Trump administration up to debate? There we are. This is from Kevin. Another scenario, US and Israel totally destroy nuclear, military and political leadership infrastructure in Iran. This hopefully means we won't have to continue with the ongoing, never-ending cycle of terrorism, murder and death in the region. Iran would be neutralised and unable to present any further problems in the region. Hopefully its people would rise up at some point and overturn the regime. Short-term pain equals long-term gain, ? Says Kevin. So there are other opinions out there. We welcome all comers here. 0333 003 2353 is the WhatsApp number. Jane Mulkerins joins us in a couple of minutes' time to discuss her new show here on Times Radio over the weekend, and indeed to tell you what's in the Times magazine this Saturday. It's Jane and Fee on Times Radio with Wix. Book your free design appointment at wix.co.uk.
Ed Vasey on Times Radio with Elavon. Join Ed tomorrow morning from 10 as he brings you a Westminster insider's view of all the day's news and political events, covering all the major stories making the headlines, with in-depth analysis and exclusive interviews, plus a look ahead to all the weekend's cultural highlights. Ed Vasey on Times Radio with Elavon. We support all payments for your business. Make one decision today. Visit elavon.co.uk.
The Story, the award-winning daily news podcast from The Times. Listen in the Times Radio app or wherever you get your podcasts.
Stop it.
At QuickFit, our customers drive away happy every time.
Get up.
Do we tickle their feet? No.
Oh, all right.
We just do our job, like having an excellent range of tyres to suit every car on the road.
Oh, that's good to know.
That's why our customers drive away happy. Quick Fit. Drive away happy every time.
This spring, start your own story in Scotland. Step into a land where the views are wild, the welcomes are warm, and the magic is real. From lofty mountains to vibrant cities, explore Scotland's breathtaking landscapes and uncover our ancient history. And with an exciting range of cultural events and festivals to enjoy, spring is the perfect time to plan your escape. Write your own Scottish story this spring. Start your adventure at visitscotland.com/spring.
Across the UK, on DAB Digital Radio, on the free Times Radio app, and on your smart speaker, Jane Garvey and Fee Glover on Times Radio.
And your thoughts on shoplifting as well. Deb says, I work for M&S in CCTV. Oh. Yeah. One of my training videos was of a burly security guard tackling a shoplifter in the car park. The man, who was well-dressed and had a flash car, had walked out with a trolley full of meat, wine and other high-value items. Mostly, the video consisted of the guard and the shoplifter disappearing to the car park bushes in a bout of energetic fisticuffs. The security guard, built like a Greek god, prevailed, and the shoplifter was prosecuted. Well, that's the way it should be, isn't it?
Well, it is, yes. Obviously, not everybody agrees with us because sometimes we can be a little bit limp and liberal, can't we?
No, we're both quite liberal and quite
a little
limp.
Too full of compassion. Yes.
I think you have to be quite brave to be a security guard these days.
I mean,
you really do. One of my friends was on the phone to me not long ago, and she was in Marks and Spencer's, and as she was on the phone to me, a man just walked out with seven coats, just watched by people in the shop and the security guard, because no one dares take them on. You don't know if they've got a knife. You know, it's you are basically, you know, having to start a fight with people who just... They've got absolutely no qualms about shoplifting in broad daylight now.
Yep, it is very brazen. Mm. And obviously that does allow people to get away with it. Nick just wants to say this. Something annoying about people breaking the law. Liberal Britain has certainly left its mark on us all, if that's the apathy message delivered. Try doing that in Saudi, where I worked over a number of years. Strangely enough, shoplifting isn't something you experience there.
Should we bring back the death penalty for stealing coats and Marks and Spencers?
We'll just send them to Australia. That's what we used to do.
Yes, let them get eaten by those crocodiles that are washing through the Northern Territory right now.
Now, Jane, you're starting your new Times Radio show at 1 o'clock?
Yes.
Saturday afternoon?
Absolutely,
yes. Tell us about it.
So it's, you know, in the kind of tradition of all the best things that I enjoy in the media, it's going to be a mix of, I guess, I'm going to loosely call it high-low, like the Times magazine, which we'll be discussing in a minute. You know, you can have hard politics, current affairs and news, and also a little bit of a sprinkling of celebrity and culture in there too. So that's the kind of basic framework and outline for the show. So I'm going to have a news panel discussing all the big topics from the week. This week we've got some big beasts from the media.
Oh,
former Times editor John Witherow and Cleo Watson, former deputy chief of staff to Boris Johnson and now, of course, celebrated bonkbuster novelist.
Yes.
So they'll be going through I want to ask John if he's read Cleo's books. We might leave that till the end. I'm going to have all the best reports from around the world, from Times correspondents in the US, in Europe. And I will have a big guest every single week. This week, it's no less than Matthew McFadyen, of Succession fame, and also Pride and Prejudice, and a new show on Sky called The Miniature Wife, which is very funny and quite surreal. And every single week, this is something I'd really like to flag up, actually. I'm going to have an agony aunt or uncle to help solve dilemmas live on air. So we know, you know, it's tricky out there. You know, there's a lot going on in the world, and we'd like to help you solve your dilemmas here on Times Radio. My first agony aunt is no less than Dolly Alderton.
Who's going to be Dolly
here.
Alderton.
The Dolly Alderton. She's going to be here to solve your dilemmas. And so we have set up a brand new sparkling email address in which you can write in with your dilemmas. Dilemmas@times.radio.
Right, I'm getting on this now.
I mean, to be fair, we could fill a whole show with ours, but I just want to say, please do, you know, emotional, relational, ethical, moral, we are here to solve all
these
things.
Can you be anonymous?
Yes, absolutely you can be anonymous, completely. We probably can't solve the Middle East crisis on air, but equally, I'm not sure we totally want to see pictures of your gangrenous toes. So somewhere in between, emotional, relational, moral, ethical problems, bring them all to us. I'm not sure I'm any use, but Dolly will be brilliant at solving them.
Well, that sounds excellent. So that starts this Saturday afternoon, 1 o'clock. You'll be lovely company throughout Saturday afternoon. Let's talk about the magazine, which is in your Times bundle on Saturday. And let's just celebrate, in a world of pain, the fact that Billy Idol is still alive.
I know. And the topic of the title of his new documentary, which airs next week, is called Billy Idol Should Be Dead. He's 70 years old. And do you know what? When I read interviews like this, I do think that perhaps the primary criteria for being a rock star is not talent or marketing or beauty. It's just constitution. Just simple constitution.
Yeah, I think you might be right.
That you can just take all the drink and all the drugs for decades and still be able to, you know, perform like Billy Idol can, because he's still performing at 70. I mean, he did fall off the stage last year, bless him. But that wasn't anything to do with the drink and drugs, because he's been sober for decades. But it's a brilliant interview by Michael O'Dell. And I mean, it really made me laugh throughout. I mean, not only has he sort of, you know, battled on through the drink and the drugs, but he seems in fine fettle at
70
as well.
He's still got hair.
He's still got hair.
Is it his? He's still got a head of hair.
He's wearing it. Okay. Anyway.
Yeah, and it's blonde.
But I have to say, I didn't know an awful lot about Billy Idol before this piece.
Well,
exactly. I am a mere child.
White wedding.
And it is brilliant interview of sort of, you know, like how he was basically studying philosophy and English at Sussex University in the late 70s when he got a call up from his mate and they said, punk's kicking off, get back to London. And then it all did. And within a few years, he was sort of living in New York with a record deal and living the high life and accidentally vomiting on David Bowie. And, you know, I mean, it is the high life and times of Billy Idol. And he does seem to have had a brilliant time with it all. I mean, there were a few dark moments there of addiction, and he did find out that he'd fathered a child he didn't know about, but he discovered that in his 60s, and now they're all a big happy family. He's a grandfather of four.
Yeah.
Do you know, his music has transferred itself through the generations, hasn't it? Because my kids really enjoy listening to him.
Do they?
And I thought, out of all of the people whose records I bought when I was 15 years old, it would not be Billy Idol, who would, you know, stand the test of time, but they absolutely love him.
I mean, and that is, I would say, the benefit of things like Spotify, because you can go and you can listen to all of, you know, the back catalogue of someone like Billy Idol, who might have been a bit niche, you know, even in the 90s, but actually that your kids can access his music so easily is brilliant.
Yeah, well, he has got some bangers, actually.
He has got some bangers, yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Anyway, it's a brilliant interview, well worth reading. Michael O'Dell and he get on like a house on fire.
Yes, it's good fun, that. I was really interested in the piece by Mark Bennett about life. Well, basically living alongside and amongst the absolute spew that comes out of Putin and his people. Just explain who Mark is.
So Mark Bennett was the Times Russia correspondent and had been living in Moscow for 25 years. It still writes a lot from Europe for us. But unfortunately, in 2022, in response to a piece that he'd written about Putin, he was told that he was banned from entering the country. He did then try to renew his visa. But just as he was attempting to renew his visa, Evan Gershwitz was taken. So when they told him that they'd lost his documents, he didn't probe it too far. And, you know, it's very sad because, you know, he lived a life in Moscow and, you know, his wife's Russian and his mother-in-law is there, they don't speak.
Because the mother-in-law initially was a reasonable woman, but she was turned.
Well, this is Mark's written an amazing book about Russia, and there's an extract from it in the magazine. And, you know, the sort of through line is the extraordinary propaganda that ordinary Russians consume on a daily basis and how much that has intensified really in the sort of 10 years plus since Crimea was invaded. Including his own mother-in-law, who barely speaks to him now because she sees him as sort of an agent of Anglo-Saxon immorality. And it is really extraordinary when you think what people are consuming and how it's affecting them in Russia.
It's an excellent piece. I highly recommend it. There's also a very important interview with a young man, very impressive one, called Ben West, who's done some wonderful work on suicide prevention and mental health help for young men. So that's really worth reading as well.
Yeah, it's an excellent interview by Ben Machel. And a lot that I didn't know, actually, about in terms of what you can do and how you engage with people who might be having a mental health crisis. It's a serious piece, but a really great read.
Jane, I hope it goes really well for you on Saturday afternoon. Jane Mulcairn's live on Times Radio 1 till 4 Saturday afternoon, starting this week.
Across the UK, on DAB, online and on your smart speaker, this is Times Radio, the voice of the times.
That takes us to 3 o'clock. You're listening to Jane and Fee on Times Radio. In the next hour of our programme, Big Tech's Little Victims, we're going to talk to a head teacher about an experiment to see what children are really looking at on social media. Should Chelsea's punishment for breaking Premier League rules be upgraded? And our big guest after 3:30 is the fabulous poet, writer and comedian Pam Ayres. Let's get the latest news first with Laura Cook.
Thank you. Good afternoon. There are concerns force majeure could be declared on long-term contracts on liquid natural gas. Overnight, Iran's attacks on Qatar damaged facilities that produce 17% of Qatar Energy's LNG capacity. 20% of the world's liquid natural gas comes from there. The CEO has said it will take 3 to 5 years to repair them. If force majeure is declared, a company can be released from contracts without any penalty. Greg Karlstrom, Middle East correspondent for The Economist, explains we're not there yet, but could be.
They've
declared force majeure on some contracts already, the sort of near-term ones that they have. These reports that are coming out are referencing longer-term contracts, things that were signed for years in the future, for delivery years in the future. Obviously, if they do end up invoking force majeure, which is sort of the act of God clause in a contract, it means there would be a sustained hit to global natural gas supplies for years to come.
Gas prices have increased 25% in the UK since the attacks on energy infrastructure by Israel and Iran yesterday. The Prime Minister denounced the closure of the Strait of Hormuz elsewhere in the strongest terms, joining European nations saying they're ready to join appropriate efforts to ensure safe passage. My apologies, this bulletin has just frozen on me, so I'm unable to bring you anything more. Apologies, Jane and Fee.
Across the UK, on DAB Digital Radio, on the Times Radio app, online, and on your smart speaker. Jane Garvey and Fee Glover on Times Radio with Wix Kitchens and Bathrooms.
Well, somebody hasn't paid the Lecky bill and we will sort it out and we will bring you that news bulletin at 3.30 in its entirety. And no problem at all, Laura. We're here for you. It's 2 minutes past three. After 3.30 today, we've got a real treat. It is Pam Ayres, a woman who Jane has interviewed several times before. And in fact, you've just got such a stunning, stunning fact about you and Pam.
Oh, it's one of my favourite anecdotes.
Come on.
No, at one point, an interview that I recorded with Pam Ayres some time ago on another network was included in the official emergency tape for... It's not so funny now, actually.
No, for when the world ends.
For apocalyptic events, because it's considered... I mean, it's no secret that obviously all broadcasters have a kind of go-to set of bits of content that can be pumped out in the event of actually an electricity problem or something like that. And so you pump out something that's inoffensive and considered to be soothing.
Yeah, and uplifting.
And, you know, uplifting.
And would see people through troubled times.
Yes. And so at one point, the emergency tape at another broadcaster did consist of me chatting through the life and times of Pam Ayres in the company of Pam Ayres. I mean, what a way to go.
So you can basically hear the commercially powered version of that today.
Yes.
After 3.30.
Today's version
is
much
more fun.
Is it
better?
Yeah, well, Pam reads a poem and, she's actually, I mean, do you know what? She sounds exactly the same as she did, I don't know, 40 years ago. I first saw her on Opportunity Knocks on the telly, although, as she explains in the interview, that wasn't actually where she started. She started at her local radio station, who were brilliant to her, and gave her a kind of weekly slot for her to read out poetry. She was very, very young, but they really stuck by her, so she feels she owes them.
I think she's a phenomenon.
She is.
Yeah.
She is.
So, Pam Ayres and Jane Garvey in troubled times after 3.30 on this station. 4 minutes past three. Now, a new campaign supported by the National Education Union has got a blunt message. Stop social media from stealing childhoods. It's called Big Tech's Little Victims, and to show how fast that theft happens, they ran an experiment at the John Wallace Academy. They created four fake profiles for 13-year-olds and invited parents and teachers to see exactly what the algorithms then serve. Now, we're going to play a selection of those clips. And a quick heads up before we start, some listeners might find these clips upsetting. But bear in mind, this is what your children are watching. First, there's Ethan from North Yorkshire. Now, he likes Fortnite and Stranger Things. But within minutes, his feed shifted from gaming clips to this.
I want you to be confrontational. I want you to learn what it feels like to walk into a room and have people be a little bit fearful of you because you're a powerful person, because you're somebody with influence, you're somebody with status, you're somebody with power.
I can't tell you how tired I am of having to argue with people that claim that there's no borders and we should allow everyone into the country when you have animals like this. Until it's your daughter, shush.
Females don't understand when guy friends is like, he only your friend because you won't let him
There's only one reason why they are friends, because they're waiting to swoop in her weakest moment.
He used an AR-15. Is that the right gun for the job?
At that distance, 100%. That's a good distance. You should be able to hit a target at 300 yards. Easy, coming out of basic training with an AR-15.
So just bear in mind, this is a fake profile that's being created for a 13-year-old boy who likes Stranger Things, which can be a little bit spooky sometimes, but is thoroughly entertaining, and Fortnite, which is one of the least offensive, aggressive online games. And within minutes, he is being shown clips about real guns, and he's being invited to hate women, and he's being invited to look at women in a purely sexual way. Hang on to all of that. Here comes Ruby from Surrey. She's a fan of Sabrina Carpenter and friendship content, but her loop quickly devolved into this.
Okay, so you are fat. We already know that. And the problem is with the fat thing is that you will look totally different once you lose the weight.
$25!
How did I do it for
$25! $25 for a good time!
I'll say it since no one else. My biggest fear is getting fat. And I think about it all the time.
So, same thing there. She likes Sabrina Carpenter. Little bit too saucy on her latest album for me, but genuinely a delightful young woman, not selling that kind of stuff. And immediately you're being told that you're too fat for a normal world. So this is the reason why we wanted to bring these things to you, because when we talk about harmful content, this is exactly what we mean. This is only about a third of what was available to us that we could have put on air, but we can't put the other stuff on air because we are governed by Ofcom and also a sense of decency about the people who are listening to our show. So you could have heard instructions on how to lose 18 kilograms in 3 weeks. You could have heard stuff about extreme body modification surgery that would be aimed at 13-year-olds, and also videos promoting self-harm. Let's talk about all of this with Damien McBeath, who is principal of the John Wallace Academy. He oversaw the experiment and watched every second of these feeds. Damien, a very good afternoon from us. Can you tell us a little bit more about what you saw and how it left you feeling?
Yeah, good afternoon. I don't think it was surprising when we spoke to the teachers and the parents who saw this. They knew that the content that children were seeing was going to be difficult to watch. But actually, what we saw was devastating. It was beyond what we would have expected to see. And the fact that this was an experiment that had been set up with profiles of 13-year-olds. It was quite clearly targeted. It was driven. The content was completely inappropriate for children. And it left people feeling angry. It left teachers and parents frustrated and slightly questioning why this has been allowed to happen, how we've let social media have access to our children in the ways that we have.
Yep. I mean, you say that parents knew that they were going to see something distressing. You work with these young people, these teenagers, all the time. I think we just cannot emphasise enough the vile nature of some of this content that's out there. I mean, it does beg a belief that it's even being made, Damien, doesn't it?
To be honest, I was absolutely shocked at some of the content. The boys, a lot of it was very manosphere. It was telling them what a real boy was, what it meant to be a man. They were encouraged not to have friends. You don't need friends. You need people to fear you. For the girls, it was very much around body image, but there was a huge amount of really inappropriate sexualized content, encouraging them to do all kinds of acts. And these are children. It's unbelievable that social media is pumping this stuff through algorithms. The fact that they are allowed to do it and our children are accessing this. It's one of the reasons why we need action rather than a consultation about this. We need to take action about it now, because children are being harmed every single day that this content is allowed to continue.
Yeah, we will come to exactly that, the point of legislation and protest. But if we focus a little bit more on the report as well, Damien, and it does say that distress is the currency. And actually, I couldn't have put it better myself. I think that is a fantastic phrase, because it tells us, doesn't it, that when these companies want to make money, they've looked very carefully about what area it is that they can make money in. And in exactly the same way that the Times might look at its readership and say, yes, a holiday in Madeira is exactly where we could make some advertising money, these companies are focusing on the dark, aren't they?
Yeah, I mean, it's called social media, but it's anything but social. They are encouraging children to isolate. They're encouraging children to spend time by themselves. And they're doing it through an algorithm which is designed to be addictive. It's designed to keep them engaged, to keep them away from their friends. And then it's feeding them. It's feeding children whose minds are still developing with a script. And it's telling them, you know, that they will tell you, your teachers will tell you this, the world is against you and what you need to do. And this script is being fed to children day in, day out, until they start to believe that the things they're hearing are normal, and they're not.
Can you ban phones? Have you banned phones in your school?
Yeah, we banned phones in our school 2 years ago. And the impact was significant. It changed the culture of the school overnight. We had children playing again. They were engaging at a much more child level. They were playing games of tick. They were talking. They were having conversations. And the smartphone has so many wonderful features and so many potential benefits. But in the hands of a child, it's taking something away from them that they don't get back, and it's taking away that childhood, and that's something that we've seen at a school level, and I think many parents know the same.
So if you're 2 years into it, what would be your top tips for schools who are still thinking about it now, and how did you deal with the very reluctant pupils who really didn't want that to be happening?
I think one of the tips would be that the pushback against it is not as strong as perhaps you might think it would be. When we were making the decision to create a phone-free policy, we were really reluctant, really concerned about the pushback that we might get from students and from parents. And we planned really carefully for what we would do in those circumstances. But when we put the policy in place, I think the whole community saw very quickly the positives, and those voices that were against it died away very quickly, because people were seeing the fact that children were learning more. They were behaving better. They were playing with their friends in the playground and talking. We are having fewer safeguarding incidents. And I think when parents saw that, when children were aware of that, I think everybody very quickly could see the positives.
There are some more benign examples, I know, from your school about what was happening. Would you like to tell us about what happened when it snowed?
Oh, yeah. We had, I was with a colleague of mine, and we were standing looking out the window, and it had started to snow, and a group of children had run outside and were catching the snow in their mouths and playing as children do. And it was one of those occasions when it struck me that the behaviour was really childish and wonderful. And they were enjoying being in the snow as opposed to filming the snow. And my reflections were that 6 months earlier, the children wouldn't have run outside. They would have taken out phones and filmed the snow because they wanted to capture a video or capture an image of the snow.
Yeah.
And we've had lots of things like that.
Yeah, that example just says so much. What would you like to see happen now in terms of what the government has the capacity to do?
We need the government to take leadership on this, because I think if you speak to teachers, this campaign was run by the NEU, that there are other teaching unions. There are lots and lots of teachers. I think over 90% of teachers know that social media is causing harm to children. If you speak to teachers, you speak to health professionals, you speak to the police, parents, you know, everybody is speaking out saying that social media is causing harm to children and are asking for action. Nobody's asking for more debate. Nobody's asking, should we spend the next 12 months discussing this further? We're asking for the government to do something to keep children safe. And I don't think that's a big ask. I think that's our duty as adults.
Do you also want to see some individuals from these main companies actually be answerable for some of the damage that they've caused?
I think they should do. If there was any product that was put on a shelf that had caused this much harm, then people would be accountable for that. You know, if there was a toy that had caused so much harm to so many children, A, you wouldn't be able to buy that toy anymore, and then the people who made that toy would have to answer for it. And the same is true with technology and social media. These things haven't happened by accident. The technology that's being used and the algorithm is very cleverly designed. They're very effective at what they do. They're designed to engage and addict children so that the children want to keep scrolling, so they want to stay on these devices. And we're seeing that have a huge impact on children's sleep levels. We're seeing children arrive in school who are tired, who aren't getting enough sleep. It's having a huge impact on their ability to interact on a daily basis. And this hasn't happened by accident. It was designed to be this way. And those who designed it should be answerable to parents and to the children themselves.
And equally, because it has been designed to create that addictive algorithm, we can assume that the technology exists to change the algorithm. So actually you could always prevent young people from seeing this kind of content.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think that's for big tech and the tech companies to find the answer to. And I think until they find the answer, we should keep this technology out of the hands of children. But they know, you know, they know what they've created, and they know that this is causing harm. I think Meta's own research indicated that it was creating more isolation in children. So they knew what they were doing long before, you know, this experiment took place. And yet they've allowed it to happen because they know that if they engage children at a young age, then they're creating customers of the future. So, it's time to hold those who've designed this to account and make sure that there are things in place to prevent it happening in the future.
Thank you very much indeed for your time this afternoon. Damien McBeath is principal of the John Wallace Academy. If you've been affected by any of the issues that we are discussing there, then you can reach out, and please do. You can email us at feedback@times.radio, and we will send over a list of resources and organisations that can help.
Now, you're listening to Times Radio, and Vassos joins us for the sport in a couple of minutes' time. It's never dull there. Secret payments, pretty awful accidents, it has to be said. We'll catch up with everything going on and chat to Vassos in a couple of minutes' time. Jane and Fee on Times Radio with Wickes, the experts in kitchens and bathrooms.
Ryan Tubridy on Times Radio.
Join me, Ryan Tubridy, every Sunday afternoon right here on Times Radio. I'll be bringing you the best of the Sunday Times, from news to literature to pop culture. We'll have all the big brains on my news panel, plenty of books to get stuck into, and the occasional celebrity appearance too. So join me every Sunday afternoon on Times Radio.
Ryan Tubridy starts this Sunday from 1 on Times Radio.
All right, we've got Simon on the line. Simon, young people, they're just all a bit lazy, aren't they?
What are you thinking?
Welcome to McDonald's.
Can I get 6 minutes, please?
Of course.
Some say young people are work shy, but at McDonald's, we hired 47,000 of them last year.
Thank you very much. How's it
going? Like George here, who keeps things running during a Friday rush. Resilience, making it happen at McDonald's.
You've saved carefully for your future, your plans, your peace of mind. Now there's good news. FSCS protection for your savings and current accounts has risen to £120,000 per eligible person at UK authorised banks, building societies and credit unions. From the very first pound right up to £120,000, it's all protected. So you can focus on what matters with confidence. See what it means for you at fscs.org.uk. Your savings, FSCS protected.
Listen to Times Radio on your DAB digital radio.
Jane Garvey and Fee Glover on Times Radio with Wix Kitchens, helping create kitchens to feel proud of. From expert design consultants who'll measure your space and bring your vision to life on a 3D plan, through to a professional installation service. Learn more at wix.co.uk.
3:21, Times Radio. What's really terrible, as you were saying earlier, Fee, is the stuff, the horrific content punted at these young children that we weren't allowed to use on Times Radio because we're governed by Ofcom.
Yep.
But apparently it's absolutely fine for your 13-year-old to have a gander.
And I think that is such a huge problem for us as parents, because we have always grown up having a guardrail between us and obscene content, because you cannot put it out on television, you can't put it out on the radio, you cannot see it in newspapers. So we have that sense that you couldn't possibly literally just click on your phone and just in one scroll find something that is encouraging you to hurt yourself or to hurt somebody else. And I think it has been very difficult for parents to go in search of the darkness, because they simply haven't known how dark it is.
And sometimes, frankly, I haven't wanted to know.
No. And it took me a long time with my own children, who are 20 and 18 now, to actually to get the courage to type into a search engine some of the stuff that I thought they might, out of curiosity, be typing into theirs. And I couldn't believe what came back. And I'm obviously not the target audience, so I don't get that algorithm, which is what Damien was talking about there. And I think that phrase, distresses the currency, is the thing that we need to hang on to. That is what they're chasing. That is what they're giving your kids.
Just have a look at Gemma's message. That's quite interesting. It's just come in. But if you want to send a bigger email, a wider email, you know what I mean, janeandfee@times.radio, and we'll include it in Off Air, our podcast, which comes your way Monday to Thursday, wherever you get your podcasts from. Now let's talk sport. Vassos is here. Some fiery stuff from Matthew Syed in the paper today. Chelsea should be stripped of their titles and trophies over so many rule breaches, not just fined. He condemns, this is Matthew, what he calls the endemic cheating that produced 47 separate rule breaches. Right, Vassos, Chelsea, this row, it's not going away.
It really isn't. And I love Matthew. He's the only person I've ever worked with. We once worked at Eurosport together doing table tennis commentary, and during the advertising breaks, we discussed Dostoevsky. Of course we did. He's Matthew Syed.
We're often to be found discussing Proust.
And I was thinking about this on Monday, and I'm talking as a Fulham fan, and I thought, do you know what? They didn't breach FFP, so they had a few dodgy payments. Financial fair play, which is what, for example, Everton, who barely breached it but got a points deduction, and Nottingham Forest, who smaller clubs, who barely breached it and got a points deduction. You know, so I thought, well, I can sort of see where the Premier League are here. It's a big old fine, £10.5 million, and it was from the previous regime, and Chelsea sort of said, you know, look what happened in our accounts previously. And I sort of thought, fair enough. And then I read Matthew and I think, no, not fair enough.
Well, no.
Strip them of their titles. So have a, you know.
It's a really, really interesting and passionate piece. And he goes right back to Abramovich and points out very clearly and simply that Abramovich's money was not good. It wasn't.
Yeah. In return for the mineral wealth of Russia, he writes, at a fraction of its true price, Abramovich and his fellow oligarchs handed President Yeltsin, then trailing in the polls, a $100 million loan and access to private TV channels. The stitch-up worked. A handful of men emerged with staggering riches. Yeltsin triumphed in the 1996 election, and his successor Vladimir Putin came to power with the state operating a fully-fledged kleptocracy. Chelsea during that era had many fans to continue to... Chelsea during that era, the fans called the golden era.
Oh, yeah.
But it was built on this essentially stolen from Russia money.
Yeah, but it was all... And there was an element of hiding in plain sight here, wasn't there? Because everybody knew... but nobody seemed to think it was worth tackling.
Exactly, and Abramovich is sort of the highest profile sort of beneficiary of what Matthew calls the London laundromat, sort of, you know, Knightsbridge, Chelsea, you know, look, oh, look, sports washing at its sort of finest, if you like. And not content with the sort of, and we all knew that the empire was built on this slightly dodgy money, because there was a high court case that Abramovich, that Matthew Syed went to see, and he mentions it in whenever it was 2012, that kind of all of this came to light. So we always knew that, and we half turned a blind eye and half didn't. Some people absolutely didn't, and you know, didn't want anything to do with it, but they were in a vast minority, and certainly of Chelsea fans, who continue to sing Abramovich's name. But whilst doing that, not content with building their fortune on this dodgy money, they then cheated. Manchester United were offered one of the players, Eden Hazard, but the agent wanted an illegal bung, and Manchester United were having none of it. But Chelsea said, yeah, no, go on then. Go on then, have that bung. So when you read this and you think, yes, absolutely, strip them of their titles. But it's a little bit like Senegal and Morocco, where, you know, Morocco were awarded the African Cup of Nations final 2 months afterwards. Senegal still had the moment. Sport is still about the moment. Yeah. You know, at no point during the Senegalese celebrations of winning AFCON did they think, oh yes, but in 2 months' time we might have breached Article 82 of the AFCON regulations.
People don't think that way.
And so when Chelsea were celebrating their Champions League and their Premier League titles...
Just remind, had Chelsea won anything until Abramovich came along?
Not really. No, yeah. I mean, they were a sort of slightly... Ken Bates, do you remember Ken Bates?
Oh, I
think, yeah. And I think Ken sold Chelsea for £1 to Roman Abramovich, but it was debt-ridden. They were small. I mean, the ground was smaller. The fan base was smaller. They were a sort of middle-of-the-table club, slightly like maybe Nottingham Forest are now, that sort of size. And then they became mega, mega rich, and it was before financial fair play, really, the early success, so they could just buy who they wanted.
Well, we'll keep an eye on it. It's a really fascinating saga.
It is a profoundly shaming episode, writes Matthew, for the game and indeed for Chelsea fans who chanted Abramovich's name. It is also shaming for the Premier League, which, with this derisory sanction, has made a mockery of its own rules.
Well said. Now, for once, Mystic Garve was correct about last night, and Liverpool did overcome Galatasaray. But there was a terrible incident featuring the Galatasaray... He's a Dutch player, isn't he?
Noah Lang.
What happened to him?
I was sort of hoping we'd run out of time with that, because this is one of those. Oh,
he will live.
I'm really sorry about this, everyone. So basically, his thumb was severed. He collided with the advertising hoardings, and he wanted to stay upright, and his thumb was jammed between two panels, which shut tight, and basically his right thumb was severed. Graham Bell, the Ski Sunday presenter, I once watched him lose the top of his finger in a door to a nightclub in Sestriere during the Turin Winter Olympics.
Your anecdotes are just better even than mine.
Incredible.
And we were scrabbling around in the snow trying to find the top of his finger while he was saying, "My wife's going to kill me." His finger was saved, Graham's, and luckily Noah Lang has posted pictures from his hospital bed. His thumb, the surgery has gone well. So I think the thumb is back on the hand. Galatasaray are saying they may sue Liverpool because what on earth sort of thing.
Well, it was, and was there something dodgy about the top of the advertising hoarding? Is that what they're suggesting?
I mean, obviously it's the Anfield ground and it should be safe for players to be able to...
And he crashed into it at some pace.
Yeah, but players do that.
Yeah, of course.
You know, absolutely. And actually, I've always thought, you know, advertising, there was a terrible story earlier this season where a young player sadly lost his life with, you know, collapsed after an advertising hoarding catastrophe, actually. So you it's one of those things that you just, again, it's sort of in plain sight, but I watch it at Fulham every week. Players, there's a downhill bit ahead of the advertising hoardings, and you think, well, actually, we've got to do something about this because people are losing their lives, people are losing their thumbs. But anyway, luckily Noah Lang is fine and his thumb is back on his hand, and Galatasaray might want some compensation, which you would probably think they would be entitled to.
That was Vassos Alexander, king of the celebrity anecdote. He's with us Monday to Thursday at this time discussing sport and his showbiz pals. And if you want more on sport, you can go to thetimes.com, go to the sports section. It's all there for you.
What happened to Graham Bell? Did you find the top bit?
We did find the top bit, and luckily it was in the snow, so we packed it in some snow, put him into a... But the nearest hospital was in Turin, which was 3 hours down the mountain. Mm. So in the middle of the night, we found a car, packed him off to Turin. It was only the sort of the top of one of his fingers, this great big metal door. We were allowed in the fire exit bit of the nightclub to stop us queuing. We sort of BBC'd our way into the back entrance.
That never happened to us at the beginning.
and then this fire door just closed as he was leaning against it, and it just severed the top of his finger. And I know he's okay. I don't know if it was ever managed to sort of stitch it back on, or if he's got a slightly shorter third finger on his left hand.
Thank you, Vassos. I really mean that.
And that's enough.
Yes.
Bye.
Quick one from James. Is there a recording of that discussion about the online issues and the algorithm? I want to send it to my wife. James, the best thing to do is get the Times Radio app, isn't it?
Yes, and you'll be able to find all of the programmes. They'll be in the archive. You just send her a little link and you'll be able to find it there. It won't be up until the end of this show, but it will be up there.
It'll be there. Yeah. Thank you, James.
Our big interview is with the poet and author Pam Ayres. Let's get a check on the latest news headlines. Fingers crossed, everybody. Here's Laura Cook.
Across the UK, on DAB, online and on your smart speaker, this is Times Radio.
Thank you. Good afternoon. Iran's overnight attacks on Qatar have damaged facilities that produce liquefied natural gas, with the company's CEO saying it'll take 3 to 5 years to repair them. It's prompted fears force majeure could be declared on long-term contracts on LNG, which means the company can be released without any penalty. Elsewhere, the World Trade Organization says the conflict poses a dire threat to global food security. It's appealed for global supply chains to remain open. Meanwhile, the Prime Minister has joined leading European nations, saying they're ready to join appropriate efforts to ensure safe passage through the Strait of Hormuz. The latest report in the COVID inquiry highlights an almost complete collapse of the NHS during the pandemic. Baroness Hallett's investigation says it was only narrowly avoided thanks to the efforts of healthcare staff. Her review also points to confusion around stay-at-home messaging, with many avoiding hospitals despite needing medical treatment. Officials say more than 900 students at the University of Kent have now been vaccinated against meningitis. A rollout of the jab on campus began yesterday, with 27 cases in the county now recorded. From next month, the cost of a UK passport will exceed £100. The price is rising by 8%, with children's applications becoming more expensive too. And actor Val Kilmer is to appear in an action-adventure film a year after his death. Generative AI version of the star will feature in As Deep as the Grave. And don't forget, you can set the Times Radio news briefing as your news service on Alexa.
This is Times Radio.
At QuickFit, our customers drive away happy every time. Do we tell them jokes? No.
All right.
We just do our job, but don't take our word for it. Take the word of thousands of excellent customer reviews on Google and Trustpilot.
There's loads.
That's why our customers drive away happy. Quick Fit. Drive away happy every time.
Feel that? That little buzz of excitement? That's the weekly flutter. With chances to win up to £10,000, enter British Heart Foundation's lottery for a thrill with goodwill behind it. Because when you play, it helps fund life-saving research. So go on, keep playing, keep winning, keep us beating. Search BHF Lottery. Gamble responsibly, over 18s only. T's and C's apply. Please see our website for more details. British Heart Foundation is a registered charity.
Get the day's politics, business and sport every weekday in Breakfast from 6:30 a.m.
Jane Garvey and Fee Glover on Times Radio with Wix Kitchens. Choose from over 80 kitchen styles. Whether it's your first home or your forever home, find your dream kitchen at Wix. Prices start from under £3,000. Book your free design appointment at wix.co.uk.
I'm afraid to say that the term national treasure is overused, but I'm going to use it again because, genuinely, it applies to our guest today, the poet Pam Ayres, MBE. Pam is now 79. She has been entertaining audiences for her entire adult life. Her new children's book is out today. It is a beautifully illustrated tome, perfect for the under-sevens or indeed for anyone, really, who values British wildlife. It's really charming and it's called I Am Dandy the Dormouse. I asked Pam if today's weather has inspired her to write.
It's very uplifting, certainly. I haven't been moved to poetry so far, but it's certainly glorious to just feel the spring in the air and see the buds fattening and all the nice things that are going on.
Yeah, I mean, in your part of the world, you are a resident of Gloucestershire.
Yes.
Yeah, and it is beautiful. Is it the Cotswolds? How would you define...
We are in the Cotswolds, you're in the Cotswolds. Yes.
But you were in the Cotswolds before the Cotswolds was the Cotswolds.
Yes, before it became the height of fashion, yes. It's very fashionable now. I'm not sure that's a good thing, but it is a gorgeous place to live and we're so lucky.
What have you seen just in the last couple of days that give us hope of a glorious summer?
Well, quite a lot, because I've spent an unwise amount of money in 2019 on 22 acres of land to manage for wildlife, because I hate the fact that it has declined so much from when I was a child. As when I was a child, you were surrounded by wildlife and there were voles along every brook and you could go and catch roach and dace and trout, and there were thousands of swifts and swallows and dozens of hedgehogs, and I've seen it all go. And it's heartbreaking to me. And so anyway, I bought this piece of land and we've dug a big pond and we've put up lots of owl boxes and bat boxes. And it's quite extraordinary what has flocked in. Now, it might not be very interesting to everybody, but I've got so many toads now in the pond. And I walked around the edges of the pond and counted 75 toads all piggybacking and getting on with breeding. And it's lovely because I don't know where they've come from. I never see a toad at other times of the year.
How would I recognise a toad as opposed to a frog? What?
They're warty. They have pustules on their skin, which are toxic, actually. So it's best not to pick them up and fondle them, should you be tempted. But, you know, they're part of the chain of wildlife. And I don't know where they were, but suddenly this time of year they all flock into my pond and I love it. And also the other day I was there and there's a lovely pair of green woodpeckers that go swooping across the field, and there are hares. So this time of year they go racing madly across a field, and there are little muntjacs, which don't really belong here, but they're quite sweet.
They're here anyway. They are sweet, but people get very angry with those things, don't they?
I know, but well, they're here now, aren't they? So we're sort of stuck with them.
Are they destructive?
I don't think... we've planted a lot of trees, a lot of native trees, but I don't think they're as harmful to trees as the fallow deer and the bigger deer that can reach up higher.
Right.
But I'm very lucky because I have got that piece of land, and so I get to see all these lovely things and I sit quietly and just watch, and it's very good for the soul.
Now, your book, your new book, which is out today... It's for children aged between 3 and 7.
Yes.
And it's about the dormouse. Now, the dormouse is am I correct in saying it's a British mammal?
Yes.
And you mentioned the chain. Where is the dormouse's place in the chain?
Well, disappearing, really.
Right.
They used to be very common. They're a native mammal. They live up in trees, which perhaps people don't realise. You don't see them very often because the clue is in the name, the dormouse. They sleep for long, long periods, for months. They hibernate. And also they live up in the trees and they eat berries and caterpillars and nuts. And, you know, they're generally scavenging up there, but you don't see them very much. They've lost habitat, which is why they've disappeared. But they're endearing little animals, and I've been greatly helped by the Woodland Trust and a lovely man called Matt Parkin, who showed me around his woodland that he looks after in Exmoor. And there they have little sooty traps where they put this kind of soot on paper, and then the dormouse walks through and leaves little footprints, and so you can see if they've been there or not. And also they had a little pregnant dormouse that he showed us, and It was the dearest little thing, this little dormouse with a fat tummy asleep, because they sleep most of the time. So I've had a lot of help from the Woodland Trust, but they are diminishing, which is sad, because, again, they're part of the chain of wildlife, and it's all losing its habitat.
So the habitat that they would, you say they're up trees, but they would also have lived in what, in like brambly-type areas?
Yes, but they do live up in the canopy of trees, which is unusual for a mouse.
Right.
And the other unusual thing about dormice is that they've got furry tails, because most mice have got scaly tails. Yeah. You know, the house mouse has got
scaly... Well, that's why they're frightening, because of the scaly tails. But we'd like a dormouse if we saw one,
wouldn't we? A dormouse has got a lovely fluffy tail. I was given the opportunity by Macmillan Children's Books to write about four native creatures of my choice, and the dormouse is suffering and disappearing. So I thought the last book in the series, there's one about an otter, one about an owl, one about a hare, and this last one is about the dormouse. And I just thought they're darling little creatures that deserved a mention. And I've spoken to various schools, and so it's lovely how interested the children are, and how... I haven't really spent a lot of time talking to children. I always thought I wasn't very good at it. But I found with this series of books about wildlife, if you sit on the floor with the children and say, anybody seen an owl? You get all these amazing responses of when they've seen them and what they sound like, and you get impersonations, and it's been magical.
Oh, that's lovely. And this book is, I have to say, it's wonderfully illustrated. You could perch a child on your knee, cuddle up, and really get absorbed in this. And there's plenty to talk about, isn't there?
There is. The illustrator is a lady called Nicola O'Byrne, and she's tremendous. And I love these books. I mean, I've worked very hard to make the rhyming story accurate and entertaining, but to pair it with her illustrations has been a genius stroke by Macmillan, I think. I didn't know Nicola. We were put together by Macmillan, and I think it works so well. There's so much detail, and you can point out things in the pictures. There's so much to look at. They're lovely little books. Well, they're quite big books,
actually,
really.
They're big books, and I think that they're actually quite bold. And it just feels an adventure, a cosy adventure.
Yes,
I would say.
Good.
Can you just read the first page,
of pages? Yeah,
please?
Well, you have to imagine I'm a dormouse. Hello, I am a dormouse, and Dandy is my name. I'm a different kind of mouse. We are not all the same. Some mice live in houses, but I'm not one of these, for I'm a little dormouse, and I like to live in trees. Dormouse is a funny name. It means to go to sleep. I hibernate in winter in a hidden leafy heap. So if you're walking quietly upon the forest floor and listen very carefully, you might hear me snore. I'm a hazel dormouse, and a hazel is a nut. Hazels are my favourite food. I love to eat them, but caterpillars, flowers, bugs and fruit are tasty too, especially blackberries, which can turn my whiskers blue.
Fantastic. I'm transported, but I'm also just lulled into a sense of security. Because, Pam, I won't need to tell you, the world is a terrifying place at the moment.
Yes, I know.
And I wonder whether you have ever been moved to poetry by a current event or by topical matters, or is that not you?
Well, I snipe from the sidelines on Twitter, as it used to be. And I didn't ever want to go on Twitter or X as it is now, because I didn't see the point. But what it's actually given me the opportunity to do is comment on topical things. So I've had a few swipes at Donald Trump and tax and topical things. So I do have a bit of fun with it, but not in an ominous way, and not in a serious political way. I have a bit of fun with current events, but there isn't much to have fun with now.
Not right now. I mean, the thing about Trump, there are many things about Trump. His name, it's got to be good for a rhyme.
Mm. Well, the last swipe I took at Donald Trump was about when he said, in order to overcome COVID, you should inject yourself with bleach. And I thought that was so hysterical. I thought I must have a go at that. So that was good fun. But I don't comment seriously on politics. I think other people are much better placed to do that than me. I try and make people smile.
And you have made people smile for, I was trying to work out how long you've been in the public consciousness, and I don't, in any way, offensive.
No, not at all.
But you started on a show that I can well recall, Opportunity Knocks.
Yes, I did. I started before that on Radio Oxford, on BBC Radio Oxford, and I like to give them a mention because they were so supportive when I had no confidence.
So you would, what, have been in your, how old were you?
I was about 27.
Right. And you were a local resident. And
they
gave you a chance.
Yeah, they used to come around the folk clubs recording for the folk programme. And I used to play my mother's ukulele and my guitar and throw in an odd jokey poem. And that's what they liked. And they asked me to write a poem to perform weekly on Radio Oxford. And I was petrified, but they gave me a deadline of 6 months because I didn't know if I could write to a deadline. And they were terrific. And as a result of that, I started to write more of this kind of poetry. I hadn't done it before.
And your household growing up, was there were six of you?
Yeah. I had four brothers and a sister, yes. Right. And then mum and dad, so there were eight of us stuffed in our house.
Six children?
Yes.
The youngest or...?
I'm the youngest, yeah.
Okay. And would it be fair to say it was... You weren't members of the artistic community, were you?
No, not at all. I mean, I loved writing. I adored writing. I didn't ever think about poetry. I liked writing stories and anything where I could use my imagination. But it was the poems that caught people's attention, and so I obliged.
Yes.
No, it wasn't. You're absolutely right. I mean, we had no books. We had two books in our house. One was called Character from the Face, which was a series of photographs of people's facial features, like noses and eyes and ears and such like. And that you were supposed to be able to read from those photographs what kind of a person they were, okay. whether they were a cad or could be trusted.
So was that useful?
No, it was a load of rubbish. And there was another horrible book we had. I don't know where it came from. Somebody must have given it to us about birds. But the birds had all been given characters. Like there was a sparrow that spoke in horrible Cockney language. I mean, we had two books and they were both horrible. So, no. And the great saving thing for me was that our school... we had a little library. It was announced that we now had a library. And I went along when I was about 9 or 10, I suppose, and the teacher gave me two books. She gave me Wish for a Pony by Monica Edwards, and she gave me Just William by Richmond Crompton.
Oh, wow, yeah.
And those two books were a revelation.
So you were transported by those books in a way that your books now transport very young children.
Well, I hope so.
Well, no, but that's sort of going full circle, isn't it?
I hope so. I hope children like my books. And when I've read them to schools, they seem to have a very nice response. And I hope it will encourage children to want to look after the wildlife, because there is a chain of wildlife. And there's a guy called Derek Gow, who's a great wildlife campaigner, and he said people talk about an ecosystem in this country, but it's just like a cobweb that's blowing in the wind. It's all broken, you know. So I'm trying to encourage children to look after our wildlife a bit better than my generation has done.
Do you regret the passing, actually, of children being read to, which increasingly we hear is genuinely under threat? And young kids, through no fault of their own, are turning up at school these days and they've honestly never held a book. They certainly don't know how to open one.
I think that's tremendously sad. There's something lovely about cuddling up with a child and reading a book. And our family still does it. My lovely sons, they prioritise reading to the children. And I, you know, my husband and I, we often go out for a pub lunch on a Sunday. We've got favourite pubs. And you so often see the child in a family group just with a screen, you know, tapping away on a screen and not participating. But I'm not pointing the finger at anybody. But yes, reading is valuable on so many different levels.
Is it true, and I love this fact, that the only poet to have outsold you in Britain is Ted Hughes?
Well, according to the bookseller, I am the second best-selling author, writer of poetry since records began after Ted Hughes.
I mean,
which is lovely, isn't it?
Well, I'd rather you were the best-selling, if I'm honest. But you have. It's not like you haven't been noticed. You've got the MBE. Is there a certain snobbery in the fact, and I'm being very careful here, I don't have the MBE, Pam, that you've only got the MBE?
I don't worry about those sort of
things. Well, I kind of worry about it on your behalf
a
bit.
Well, I'm not belittling myself or my achievements, but I never set out to be a poet like Sylvia Plath or any of the proper poets.
Are a proper poet.
Well, thank you. Yes, I think I am, but my value is that I can make people laugh and I can home in on subjects that people think about but perhaps don't verbalise. I don't mind that I haven't been made a dame. Why would I want to be a dame anyway? People say that to me a lot now. They say, you ought to be a dame. But it's not something that comes into my consciousness. I perform lots of evenings in theatres and they're always sold out.
People turn out to see you.
They're
always
sold out. And people always laugh and they go home and their mascaras run and that is reward.
It's not something Ted Hughes ever did.
Well, I don't know. But that's my reward and that's ample.
All right. Let's hear a poem you've written as a way of ending this lovely conversation. And thank you, Pam. This is about online shopping.
Yeah, this is about online shopping. It's called I'll Have to Send Them Back. Those shoes, they looked so beautiful, so stylish and refined. A little motif on the front, a shapely heel behind. I ordered them and waited for the courier to call. Delivery was swift, he threw them straight across the wall. Through the air they travelled and they landed with a thud. Thanks a lot, I shouted and retrieved them from the mud. But the package had arrived, and that had blown away the blues. For what is more uplifting than a nice new pair of shoes? Wrapped in tissue paper, white as snow, the footwear lay. I picked them up admiringly and turned them every way. I placed them on the carpet, and with luxury they shone. But having these gigantic feet, I couldn't get them on. I'll have to send them back. I'll have to send them back. The ruddy things are useless. I'll have to send them back. Down the post office, I'll be glaring at the clock, standing in a queue that's going halfway round the block. Oh, I'm done with online shopping. It's just a loser's game. The goods all look enticing, but they go back just the same. Although, that is a lovely dress before me on the screen. I need one for a wedding, and that's the nicest one I've seen. Oh, I could cut a dash in that. I'd be dressed to kill. The model's only 17 and beautiful, but still. Where'd I put my credit card? My little plastic friend. Next day delivery. That'll do it. Send.
Fantastic. Pam, thank you very, very much.
Thank you.
What size are your feet?
I'm not going to tell you.
But you're tall.
8.5 they are.
8.5.
But they're big, Jane, and wide and knobbly.
I can't believe that, can you? Pam Ayres, wide, knobbly feet, not having it.
Did she say 8.5? Wow, that is big.
But she's tall. She's 5'9". So she's a statuesque presence, is Pam Ayres.
Yes, she is.
Yeah.
She walked through the office today. I felt it.
Yeah, no, well, good. Anne says, that was a delightful breath of gentle, warm spring air, that interview.
Well, we all needed it, didn't we?
Kind of the atmosphere we wanted to conjure, really, with Pam Ayres, because she's just something a little bit more restful than the current news and current affairs content, I think it would be fair to say. Tansy says, I have loved Pam since I was a child, and I still do. And Jonathan simply contributes, go, Pam. Thank you. Still somebody people want to hear from, and I do love the fact that she's Britain's second best-selling poet after Ted Hughes.
I know which one I'd go to.
Well, indeed.
You're listening to Jane and Fee on Times Radio with Wix. You can book your free design appointment at wix.co.uk.
Times Radio, Market Watch, in association with FNC Investment Trust.
Listen to Times Radio to hear all the latest financial news from all the global stock markets. Get insight, analysis, and up-to-the-minute information to help you get the most from your investment portfolio. Times Radio, Market Watch. Throughout the day, every Monday to Friday, on Times Radio, in association with F&C. It's smart to start with F&C. Find out more at fnc.com. Capital at risk.
Coming soon, rowing's greatest rivalry, live and exclusively on Times Radio.
I believe those who are curious see the world differently. At Viking, we have always been curious and quite a bit different. For over 25 years, we have been connecting the thinking person with the world. First on the great rivers, then on all five oceans, now on all seven continents. We are One Viking. Exploring the world in comfort.
Donations to British Heart Foundation fund scientific research that can help save lives. People like Joe, who's pitching his next big business plan. Maria, who's sending out her wedding invitations. And Jack, who's just being a teenager again. Because when you donate, you fund more than just science. You help save lives. British Heart Foundation funds research that aims to cure inherited heart muscle diseases. But our work is not done. Donate now at bhf.org.uk and keep us beating.
The State of It USA is the new podcast from The Times and The Sunday Times that brings you real truth about US politics and power. Join political heavyweights Katie Balls and Gerard Baker as they take a deep dive into the latest wrangles in the White House and bring you intelligent analysis and insight.
I went out on the road this week with the First Lady and we rode back in the motorcade.
No fake news, no flag waving, and no Trump derangement syndrome. Just the inside track on the decisions that are shaping America. The State of It USA is available now on the Times Radio app or from your preferred podcast provider.
Across the UK, on DAB Digital Radio, on the free Times Radio app and on your smart speaker, Jane Garvey and Fee Glover on Times Radio.
The Japanese Prime Minister is currently in the company of President Donald Trump, and you'll hear quite how that encounter is going in the company of John Pienaar after 4 o'clock. I don't think it's well, she's playing the game, which they all have to play, which is, I think, telling him how great he is. How do you think it's? We're going on the body language, aren't we?
We're going on body language and some subtitles, and she does appear to be saying all of the things that Donald Trump would want to hear. She is wearing Margaret Thatcher blue. She's dressed in a Maggie Thatcher blue suit. Yeah. I would say, Jane, and read into this what you will, it is rare to see a woman in the White House with that long, blow-dried hair.
Yeah, that's actually...
There is a look that's a at good the thing. Moment. Yes.
Very good thing.
So we commend her on her short, practical and very efficient hairstyle.
Yes.
We've talked about the size of women's feet. We've talked about women's hair. Let's tell you what's on the programme
next
week.
Well, we can't fault Donald Trump's appearance, so we wouldn't even dream of it, would we?
We can't fault his hair. Is it hair? David Soleil is on the programme next week. Booker Prize winner. His book Flesh, told entirely through the male gaze, is a very interesting one to talk about at the moment. And Baroness Debonair, Thangam Debonair, will be on as well, telling us about the non-fiction contenders in the Women's Prize. And those are always fascinating. And we've got a particular favourite of yours as well, a book about siblings, Jane.
Yes, well, this is an old colleague of mine, Catherine Carr, has written a book called Who's the Favourite, which I think explores one of those areas of family life that isn't really as discussed as it probably should be. It's about siblings, which unusually your relationship with your sibling or siblings, if you're fortunate, and obviously terrible things do happen, that will be the longest relationship of your life. And
one of the most defining.
I would say it absolutely is. I also appreciate plenty of people don't have siblings. They might have dearly loved them, or they're very glad they haven't had them, whatever it might be. I've covered every base, haven't I there?
You've done an absolutely perfect BBC balance.
Thank
there.
You. But nevertheless, I've read the book and it's really interesting. How you get on with your sibling or siblings is of vital importance and may in some ways dictate the entire course of your life. That's next week.
So we hope you can join us for that. John Pienaar is next. Our producer today was Felix Forbes. Our technical operator was Ryan Boyden. If we're all still here, we'll see you next week. Have a lovely weekend when you get to it.
Across the UK, on DAB digital radio, online and on your smart speaker. This is Times Radio, the voice of the times.
Thank you, Jane. Thank you, Fee. At 4 o'clock, I'm John Pienaar with Times Radio Drive, and here are the headlines. There are concerns that force majeure could be declared on long-term contracts on liquid natural gas. And COVID inquiry has concluded the guidance to stay home, protect the NHS and save lives led to thousands missing out on life-saving care for things like cancer and heart attacks. And coming up, Times Radio's business correspondent Dom O'Connell and the chair of the Commons Energy Committee, Bill Esterson, joining us on the pressure building up on the government to respond to the growing concerns a major cost of living crisis is coming round the corner. And Times Radio's political editor Anna Mihailova has an interview with the leader of the opposition, Kemi Badenoch.
This is Times Radio.
And we're after the news with Laura Cook.
Thank you. Good afternoon. There are fears force majeure could be declared on long-term contracts on liquid natural gas. Overnight, Iran's attacks on Qatar damaged facilities that produce 17% of Qatar Energy's LNG capacity. 20% of the world's liquid natural gas comes from there. The CEO has said it will take 3 to 5 years to repair them. If force majeure is declared, a company can be released from contracts without any penalty. Greg Karlstrom, Middle East correspondent for The Economist, explains we're not there yet, but we could be.
They've declared force majeure on some contracts already, the sort of near-term ones that they have. These reports that are coming out are referencing longer-term contracts, things that were signed for years in the future, for delivery years in the future. Obviously, if they do end up invoking force majeure, which is sort of the act of God clause in a contract, it means there would be a sustained hit to global natural gas supplies for years to come.
Gas prices have increased 25% in the UK since the attacks on energy infrastructure. The Prime Minister, meanwhile, denounced the closure of the Strait of Hormuz in the strongest terms, joining European nations saying they're ready to join appropriate efforts to ensure safe passage. The COVID inquiry has concluded the guidance to stay home, protect the NHS and save lives led to thousands missing out on life-saving care for things like cancer and heart attacks. The chair, Baroness Hallett, also says the health service only just avoided collapse during the pandemic. Kemi Badenoch has told Times Radio she would intervene if she came across a shoplifter, depending on how big they were. The Conservative Party leader also said stronger people should do more to tackle crime. She was speaking to Times Radio's political editor, Anna Mihailova.
I think it depends on how big they are.
Good answer. And similarly...
But yes, broadly would be my instinct. I think people should look after their personal safety. I think those people who are stronger should do more. I know that there is now a tendency for people not to put themselves in harm's way, but I also think that sometimes we need to send a message that this is not acceptable.
And you can hear the rest of that interview with John on Times Radio Drive following this bulletin. There are 27 cases of meningitis in an outbreak which started in Kent, up from 20. Two young people have died so far. The health secretary, who said the risk to the public is very low, has been visiting Kent where students have been vaccinated. Pharmacist Thorund Govind says people shouldn't panic.
Unless you're in Kent or close to this, I don't think people should be trying to access this vaccine right now. We need to focus the supply on those who really need it.
The cost of a standard UK passport is to rise above £100 for the first time. The Home Office is defending the 8% increase for online applications. And don't forget, you can set the Times Radio News Briefing as your news service on Alexa.
Across the UK, on DAB Digital Radio, on the free Times Radio app, and via your smart speaker.
John Pienaar on Times Radio Drive with ServiceNow.
Hello, I'm John Pienaar with Drive on Times Radio. Thanks for joining me. A deep breath. Energy prices up sharply. The cost of public borrowing up suddenly. The latest news on the Middle East crisis is not for the faint-hearted. You don't need to be an energy economist to know that the news that the Gulf state Qatar, the world's biggest supplier of gas, declaring that it may be breaking its contracted obligations to customers across the world is bad news for all of us. The power is called force majeure. It means dealing with events it can't control, and having its major gas installation, the biggest in the world, hit by an Iranian airstrike after days of Iranian attacks on other civilian and military targets. Well, I guess that falls into that category. And whatever you call it, it is bad news, more bad news for supplies, for prices. And on the programme, we're going to try and gauge how bad. And that is on top of worries that the war may develop into a tit-for-tat of strikes against energy fields and installations. President Trump has now warned Iran that he'll massively blow up, as he put it, Iran's huge gas field, the South Pars field, if there's another attack on Qatari energy targets. The Iranian strike, by the way, was in retaliation for an Israeli attack, the latest on the world's biggest liquefied natural gas facility, which Donald Trump described as Israel acting violently, lashing out without his knowledge or approval. Is that true? Was it? Would Israel do that? Israeli officials deny it. Does Donald Trump know what he's talking about or what he's doing? We're going to be addressing those questions for you, and I'll be asking if we can avoid the war heading into a new chaotic phase in which oil and energy fields and installations are struck and destroyed on both sides, with all that that means for energy prices and economies here and around the world. But let's not be alarmist. How do you see this crisis playing out? And what do you want to hear from the British government and from the Prime Minister Keir Starmer? Send me a text, 87222. Start with the word Times or a tweet to @TimesRadio. First then, Iran's missile attacks on Qatar's Ras Laffan industrial complex have just escalated the global energy crisis. This was after an Israeli attack on Iran's energy and gas field South Pars. The Qatari Prime Minister said the Iranian strikes were a very dangerous escalation. He's demanded an immediate end to attacks. I've been talking to Dominic O'Connell, Times Radio's business correspondent, and I asked him what the attack means for the markets.
Well, the gas prices spiked overnight because of the attack on the Ras Laffan export facility in Qatar. Qatar, like Iran, sits on top of the world's biggest gas field. Most people think it holds as much gas as all the rest of the world's gas fields put together. Mm. And it's responsible for about 20% of the liquefied natural gas around the world. 20% of that comes from this one facility in Qatar. This afternoon, the head of Qatar Energy says that the attack has taken out 17% of that facility's capacity for 3 to 5 years. So they have 14 of what are called trains, the things that take the gas at one end and cool it, compress it, and eventually liquefy it. Two of those are damaged and will take between 3 to 5 years to repair. And this is extremely bad news for the world gas market. Mm. Most of the shipments from Qatar go east. They go through the Straits of Hormuz and then go off to Asia. But it is a global market for gas, and those Asian countries who now can't count on supply from Qatar will be competing from shipments from the US, which is where we get most of our imported gas from. Mm. The gas price spiked earlier today at about 175p a therm. Before the conflict started, it was down around 70p a therm.
What is this likely to mean for the supply and cost of gas? I mean, how disruptive and costly might this be?
Well, it means you're taking a large chunk of supply that had been counted on over the next years. You're just taking it off the market. It will push the price of gas up. And it also raises the specter, along with the right increased oil price, of increased inflation in Western economies, and particularly in the UK, which has shown itself pretty susceptible to inflation in the last sort of 5 years or so.
Have you any clue as to which parts of the globe